This is Bristol Bay & Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, September 18th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week,
I'm certain that there will be open discussions about the possibility to take perhaps some of the competitive nature away from lodges and the industry in general.
We'll speak with one area Sportfish Lodge owner about this week's floatplane crash that killed three guests of a lodge in Illiamna. The fall moose hunting season is wrapped up for many on the west side of Bristol Bay. We'll get a preliminary update from Fish and Game, plus hear from a few of you on your efforts.
And then you can go something like,
This weekend, there will be many out to participate in a run honoring a man who is becoming more of a name than a memory. We'll reflect on Dillingham Police Officer Tony Jones, killed in the line of duty in February 1992.
Rose to the occasion without being told. Never failed to give a hand. In fact, the night he was killed, I think he voluntarily came in just to make sure there was a backup.
Plus, the new music teacher in Dillingham stops by to play this week's show out.
I loved classical music as a kid. I'd listen to it for hours, and I just would want to play all those pieces that the professionals were doing as, you know, as a 12-year-old or so.
Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. On Sunday, the U.S. Coast Guard hoisted three people off a fishing vessel in the waters near Togiak. Petty Officer Grant DeVoist says the rescue came just in the nick of time, with winds blowing at 35 miles an hour and seas up to 5 feet.
Coast Guard Sector Anchorage Command Center watch standards received a call from the crew of a fishing vessel, the Lady K, that they were experiencing some pretty nasty weather conditions and that their vessel was disabled. So they were trying to drop an anchor, but were having trouble due to the weather.
The vessel Lady K did run aground on the rocky coast shortly after the three were rescued. Early Tuesday morning, a float plane from a fishing lodge crashed in Illiamna, killing three and wounding the other seven on board. The de Havilland Turbine Otter had just taken off from East Wind Lake en route to a day's fishing when it crashed a few hundred yards from the lake's edge. State Trooper Joe Menick was on the scene early, along with what he says was an incredible volunteer response from the village.
With an amazing show of support, most of the community in Illiamna, New Halen, were on scene to hike the roughly 400 yards through the tundra to get to the crash site. And with their efforts, we were able to transport the medically injured or the injured from the site and get them to the local clinic for treatment.
Sue Nealon was among the many helping pull the wounded from the plane that morning.
We had to load them on the gurneys and get them all ready to be packed out.
The Turbine Otter was owned and operated by the Rainbow King Lodge. It's believed the lodge owner was on board and among the survivors. Three lodge guests were killed, 80-year-old Tony DeGroot and 70-year-old James Fletcher, both from California, and 69-year-old James Spector from Pennsylvania. The National Transportation Safety Board has not released information yet about what might have led to the pre-dawn crash. This week, Alaska's local boundary commission briefly considered, then quickly dismissed a petition to create a borough in western Bristol Bay. The petition was created by the state's Department of Community and Regional Affairs as a possible solution for the competing Dillingham and Manicotic annexation petitions. Four of five commissioners were present, and for now the Tikchik Borough, which would have encompassed roughly what is the Dillingham census area, was dismissed after a tied 2-2 vote of the commissioners. Daryl Hargraves was one of those opposed.
One of the concerns I have is if the commission takes this action, does that prejudice a future efforts in the consideration of a petition? I have a concern. Why would we do it here and not do it in some other places? I think that if we did it here, we can find several places across the state where such action would be just as justifiable.
There was mixed reaction this week from local stakeholders on whether the state-driven proposal to form a borough was a good idea or not. Fall fishing in Area M is winding down quickly after a bigger and later season than was expected. Matt Keyes is the management biologist for the South Peninsula.
Overall, the season was actually pretty good. We normally harvest around 2 million sockeye a year, and we ended up with 3.2 million sockeye harvest. And then the next species that kind of really stands out are pink salmon. We were expecting 13 million, and ended up with almost 16.7 million pink harvested.
Key says that makes it the biggest pink harvest for Area M since 1995. The 6 million sockeye harvest was nearly double last year's catch, and prices seem to be about half of what was paid last year. The Dillingham City Council approved a contract for a fuel purchase of diesel and gasoline, awarded this year to Bristol Alliance Fuels, which is now owned by the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. City Manager Rose Loetta says even with additional diesel being used by the new landfill incinerator, the city is expecting to save $146,000 in fuel costs this year.
We went with the lowest bidder, which was Bristol Alliance, at $2.50 a gallon for number one diesel, $2.75 for number two diesel, and $2.95 for gasoline. Compared last year, same categories, $4.19 for diesel and unleaded gas. The bid was for $4.21, and that was with Vitus.
And tonight, the Dillingham Wolverines will gather for the first high school homecoming celebration in more than 20 years. Bill Schwann is the principal and has been helping organize tonight's event.
Most schools, maybe in the lower 48 or even in Alaska that have football, would call it homecoming. And so I found out that it's been over 20 years since we've had anything like this. And so what better way to kick off things with a big old bonfire on your school properties?
In place of football, the Dillingham cross country team has an invitational tomorrow in downtown Dillingham. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Our top story this week: on Tuesday, a float plane crashed in Iliamna, killing three of the guests of the Rainbow King Lodge, who were among 10 bound for a day's sport fishing. Authorities have not yet said what may have caused the crash. The pilot survived and was hospitalized, and the NTSB plans to talk with him this week. The plane left for fishing before dawn, which is not common among most in the industry, and there was plenty of talk around the bay this week about a competitive nature to get to the rainbow trout hotspots late in the season first. Nancy Morris-Lyon is the managing partner of the Alaska Sportsman's Bear Trail Lodge in King Salmon and joins me now for Reaction. Nancy, it's always good to speak with you. Certainly tragic news this week for those involved, but tell me how this air accident is being received and what I've come to learn is a pretty close-knit sport fishing industry here in Bristol Bay.
Yeah, Dave, it is. These type of things are always really, really tough on everybody. You don't even have to be necessarily directly affected, but, you know, we all mourn losses like this. It's hard on all of us. Obviously, it brings humanity back to life for all of us, and it makes us all realize, you know, the need for us all to truly take advantage of the good things that we've got around and the things that go right and help those out that have things go wrong.
The sport fishing industry up here is, for many of us, it's kind of behind the scenes. We don't see a whole lot of the activity because it's kind of tucked away in around the region here, but float planes are up every day taking a fisherman to some spectacular spots, but these incidents like this don't seem to happen very much. What's your recollection of accidents or tragedies within the region's industry?
You know, we'd love it if we could be sure that it never happened, but obviously that's not anything in our control, and we have had accidents like this happen before, and just one makes them far too often than we'd like to remember them to be. But we all try to regroup afterwards. We try to reevaluate our own plans and safety measures that we take. We go over our own maintenance programs to make sure that we have everything that we can possibly think of covered. If we can learn anything from them, we certainly do, and we do our very best to implement it because it's, you know, this tragedy hits the whole industry, not just the certain lodge that it was attached to at the time.
Let me ask you about that and point out that we don't have any confirmation of what may have led to that accident or any possible cause. But even before that occurred, there's been talk that in this late season there are places to get to that people really want to get there first. And I gather that that's not common to the whole industry, but There was talk this week after the accident of possible regulations or lottery to use certain creeks or rivers that are the hot spots as in late fall here. Do you think anything will change after this accident? Still pointing out that we don't know what led to the cause here.
Yeah, we don't know what led to the cause, and we don't want to speculate on that by any means. Like I said before, we try to evaluate each and every time something like this happens within the industry, our own measures and our own things that we need to take more care and better care of. And so I'm certain that this is going to come up. I'm certain that there will be open discussions about the possibility to take perhaps some of the competitive nature for those mornings away from lodges and the industry in general. You know, anytime we can do anything to improve the safety for our guests, we're doing a great service for them and ourselves as well.
I think most lodges are wrapping up very shortly here. Is that the case with you? And how was the season overall until this unfortunate incident this week for everybody?
Yeah, we've had a really good season up until now. I mean, it really puts a damper on the year, but we've had a very good year. I'm actually a resident from out here in Bristol Bay, so I tend to stay open longer than most, and I still have about a month to go. But you are correct. From most of my friends are wrapping up either this week or in the following week. So a lot of the plane traffic from overhead will soon be silent, and things will be put away for another year. But I think overall we had a fairly good year this year again.
Always good to speak with you, Nancy Morris-Lyon. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you, Dave. Always appreciate it.
For better or for worse, the fall hunting season has wrapped up now for many of us. To see how we collectively did or are still doing, let's check with area wildlife biologist Neil Barton in the Dillingham office of the Department of Fish and Game. Neil, good to speak with you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. Most of 17 wrapped up this week. 17A still continuing till the 20th. But what's the initial take? How have hunters done this this fall moose hunting season?
Well, as of now, we've got 106 moose recorded taken in the 583 registration permit hunt from 17 B and C. It's a little behind. Last year, we finished the 146, I believe. You know, we still have a lot of hunt reports coming in. A lot of them are sent to Anchorage and get scanned there. So we'll see. Maybe by early to mid-next week, we should pretty much have a final tally.
Okay. What about participation? Do you know how many permits were registered for this season and how this compares to others?
About the same. You know, we generally get, I looked over the last 10 years, we generally get about 650 to 700 people actually hunting. And I think this year's going to be right in the same ballpark. So the participation in the hunt seems about the same. But, you know, this year in particular, after talking to a number of hunters, you know, the wind conditions were really kind of hampered hunting a bit. And then as well as the low water seemed to keep people out of a lot of places they normally would probably hunt.
What else are hunters telling you as they're kind of coming in and out? Did they have more success early on, late in the season when temperature finally dropped just a bit, or what was your take?
Oh, people were excited when they did get a couple of cold days, that's for sure. But the common themes that I've heard were kind of three things. One, the low water made it difficult to get to more like traditional hunting spots and back sloughs, that kind of thing. Two was warmer weather. A number of hunters told me they heard bulls grunting, but they weren't able to bring them to them. They found that kind of frustrating, where previous years or in conditions where it was a lot cooler, they thought the bulls were much more active and much more ready to come into a call. Of course, the windy conditions were one of the main things that, you know, and I've known that, you know, generally speaking, moose, they use their ears a lot to kind of figure out what's going on, and they get a little anxious and nervous when it's really windy, and they're just not as likely to be moving around and be available for hunters.
Neil, it's probably as good a time as any to remind hunters, many of whom ran into this problem this season, to turn those registrations back in so as not to void themselves out for next year.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is a great time to say that. And, you know, for all the hunters out there, now is the best time, when hunting's fresh on your mind, to turn in your hunt reports or get online and report there. We need that information. And just make sure you fill the whole card out, you know, where you hunted, how many days, you know, if you use commercial services, that kind of thing. Because sometimes we get the cards in and they're only partially filled out, and then we have to call people. So, but it's a good time to get that done, and then you can move on to the winter season in a few months.
Neil Barton is with the Wildlife Conservation Department at the Fish and Game Office in Dillingham. Neil, thanks as always for the update.
Hey, you're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
And we sent KDLG's Hannah Colton around this week to find out how some of you did this fall and see if we could get any of those great stories you come back with on the record. She brought us this report.
I ran into several hunters who decided to skip moose season this fall. Longtime resident Steve German says this fall was too warm and buggy.
I didn't want to deal with all the no-see-ums and white sox, so it's too much of a hassle. So I'd rather hunt geese.
For those who did go out for moose, it was a game of patience and luck. 12-year-old Amaya Wassily Walker was hoping to get his first moose outside Clark's Point, but he didn't catch one yet.
When we went out, there was nothing. All we seen was a cow, a big cow. Looked like a bull.
Also unsuccessful in moose efforts was Terry Fuller, but he did share a story from his family's caribou hunting trip. He said he was a proud dad taking his 15-year-old daughter on her first big game hunt.
It was a little more daunting than shooting at cardboard cutouts at the dump, and she missed it clean, and she just felt so bad about it. And anyway, I could not have been more proud. She really impressed me. She impressed me to the point where I'm thinking, you know, I was kind of against the idea, but the idea of her getting a winter moose tag, I'm warming to the idea now after watching her out there, so.
Stormy conditions last weekend may have put a damper on some people's trips. We heard a story of one couple who had a wild boat ride bringing back a 60-incher in gale-force winds. But the storm was a nuisance for those on land, too. Here's solo hunter Andy Aderman.
I'll have to admit that I quit hunting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and crawled into the tent, and I stayed there until 7 o'clock the next morning because it just rained and it blew all night long.
Aderman did get a moose with lucky timing on the last morning of the season. He says he's looking forward to eating pickled moose heart. Perhaps the happiest hunting party I found were out on Thursday evening cleaning out their skiff and preparing to cut up a third moose among them. They shared some of their secrets to success.
Ninja skills. You gotta have ninja skills.
Chad Feltz, along with his sister Sherry Graywall and hunting partner John Castile, spent the better part of a month upriver. Besides stealth, Chad says the key to a successful hunting trip is each person finding the moose that's specifically meant for them. He explained it's like in video games.
Your name will kind of always follow your character. So there's like the bubble name tag above the moose's head while he's walking around. And, you know, it's going to say John Castile as above his head or Sherry Graywall walking around somewhere. You got to find your moose with your name on it.
Sherry found the one with her name on it the morning after they packed out her brother's moose.
I was using John's 300, and I got as close as I could. And I was so nervous, and my scope is fogging up. My glasses are fogging up. Like, I'm like, this is it. Like, this is it. And so then, like, finally, John was like, if you could see it in the scope, shoot it. And so I just, like, took a deep breath, and I shot. And then I seen its antler drop. And then, like, I just started chasing after it. And, like, I'd gotten my moose. And I got the biggest one, 63 inches. Yeah, I got a trophy.
Chad's 12-year-old son, Chevy, has been accompanying his dad on hunting trips for 4 years now. But he thinks he and his sister might not quite have the ninja skills down.
I don't know. As soon as we weren't there, my dad and them got a moose. Like, we went to school and then they got a moose. I think we're too loud moose hunting.
They might be noisy, but Chevy and his sister, 10-year-old Cheyenne, are a help when it comes to butchering.
It was cool seeing a moose, the inside of the moose and stuff. But, like, the belly was bloated and, like, we accidentally popped a little hole in it and it started to stink really bad.
Did it gross you out?
Not really. I didn't puke.
For this crew, the hard work and long days are all worth it for time spent in the outdoors with family and friends. Castile says it's an emotional high.
You're just happy. Sometimes you get tear two in your eyes. You guys are hugging each other like crazy, giving high fives, yelling and screaming.
You're the boss for the day if you just got your moose.
Oh, yeah. You are the boss for the day if you got the moose.
Now that the freezer's full, it's time to think about what's for dinner. For this hunting clan, they said Mongolian moose, lots of roast moose sandwiches, and about 20 pounds of moose hot dogs. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
This Sunday, more than 60 runners, walkers, and bikers will gather for the annual event known as Tony's Run, now in its 24th year. The event honors former Dillingham police officer Anthony Jones, known better as Tony, or by his nickname Flip. Jones was killed in the line of duty in the early hours of February 12, 1992. It was a cold, dark winter's night. Patrons leaving the CN bar reported gunshots fired in their direction. Dillingham police were called to the scene. Jones was among three off-duty officers who responded. He was killed instantly by a .22 caliber round to the head and may have never known who or where his killer was. He was the first and only DPD officer killed in the line of duty. Inside the old Hildebrand's hardware store, a troubled young man had amassed an arsenal of rifles and ammunition and continued firing shots out of the window over the next 14 hours. 17-year-old Eugene Maud was eventually taken into custody and is currently serving a 65-year jail sentence. Officer Tony Jones was 36 years old at the time of his death. According to reporting at the time, which was compiled in the book Forgotten Heroes by William Wilbanks, Jones was born in Salisbury, Maryland, the second of three children, and he moved to Haines, Alaska in 1982. He attended the police academy on his own dime and was hired by DPD in 1990, serving less than 2 years before he was killed. He was survived by his wife and daughter. Tony Jones was an African-American man who left a lasting legacy on the department, the community, and especially the youth he had gone out of his way to work with and inspire. Joining me now for more is former Dillingham police officer Terry Rogers, who also responded to the scene that night 23 years ago. It's good to have you in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Dave.
Tell me about Tony.
Tony was, I knew Tony a little special because he's from East Coast, Maryland. East Coast of Maryland, in fact, been to his hometown. He'd been with the department a couple of years. Easygoing fella, one of the finest human beings I ever met as far as kindness and helping other people. The thing I remember most about Tony, I think the folks in this town that knew him, and it dawned on me here the other day that a lot of folks don't know him or did not know him because he's young enough. Tony worked with a lot of kids at the school before DARE was an issue, before it was a program. He'd play pickup basketball at the court. He did martial arts. He was a DARE officer before there was DARE.
What was it that inspired him to reach out to the kids in particular?
I don't know. It was just his personality. He was a magnet, though.
How was he as an officer? He wasn't here long before he was killed.
I think he was here a year and a half or two, something like that. It was a short time. Never failed to give a hand. In fact, the night he was killed, I think he voluntarily came in just to make sure there was a backup. Rose to the occasion without being told.
Hmm. Let's go back to that February. Tell me a little bit about that evening.
I was off duty. We had one officer that was on duty. There was reports of shots being fired in the alley behind NNN. I don't know how detailed I think I want to be on this, but Tony and I both responded to back up the officer that was on duty. I do remember the night, and I do remember looking up the weather history. It was 6 degrees, and it was ice fog. You could see, but it was ice fog, and it kind of still and quiet.
Did all officers respond that night eventually?
No, not all officers did respond because all officers weren't available. We had two out of town. We had one that was not able to respond, and that left Tony, myself, and one other officer, Dave Kirby. Two of us went to the scene with the third one already there. So there were three officers at the scene.
Shots fired doesn't necessarily trigger. It could be any number of things. It could be
firecrackers, anything.
Right. Were you suspicious that this was going to be as bad of a night as it turned out to be?
Not at all.
And this was right downtown in a building which building was it? Is it still there?
The building from where the shots were fired is still there. It's, for the folks that knew, it was Hildebrand's. It's a little storage house building west of NNN Market. There were some other buildings there at the time besides that are not there now. The old Fisherman's Co-op or QFC or at that time it was being used as Dillingham Chamber of Commerce. That building was there.
According to reports at the time, Eugene Maude had loaded and fired 15 guns during the incident, including 22, 243, and 30-30 caliber rifles, as well as 12-gauge and 20-gauge shotguns. As dawn broke that cold Wednesday morning, downtown Dillingham was on lockdown, and state authorities were called in to help with the standoff. Maude made suicidal comments from inside the hardware store and continued firing shots. Early on, Terry Rogers was also nearly killed, a subject he says he's not entirely comfortable discussing in much detail today.
I'll talk a little bit, but not much. I ran to the scene and found myself in harm's way. But I had enough of an advance warning, I guess. Either by the grace of God or sheer dumb luck, I didn't meet the same results as Tony. Took a bullet through the hat and some others of higher caliber shrapnel in the face. The incident did not finalize until about 3 p.m. the following afternoon, so it went for, if my math is right, about 15 hours with Eugene in the store, and we were taking care of the perimeter best we could. We did have a trooper respond, and a probation officer, and a Fish and Wildlife Enforcement trooper. And we ultimately got support from the State of Alaska CERT team out of Anchorage. But that's an eight-hour best-case scenario response. It was a very eventful 15 hours.
Tell me about the aftermath of losing an officer like Tony to his family and to town.
The family I can't speak much for, except I know it's been very traumatic for his widow. And I have seen her years since. He left a daughter, and I do not know his daughter. I think as far as the department goes, it never goes away, sometimes better than others. And I think others, probably like myself, wonder why you can walk away and someone else can't. Same as military folks. The impact on the town was tremendous. The gymnasium was packed, a standing room only, for the first memorial, or the last one, I forget which. There was a series of memorials, one here and one in Southeast as well, maybe another one. I think it impacted the police enforcement statewide as well. We had a assistance for the memorial services from Anchorage Police Department. Chaplain actually came out and gave a very needed hand on that. So the impact on that in the small town is tremendous. We've gone through a couple others here in Bristol Bay in the 30 years that I've been here. And to back up to your former question, the impact it's had has profoundly impacted, in my estimation, Eugene Maude.
That afternoon, Eugene Maude was taken into custody, where he has remained ever since. Maude entered into a deal with state prosecutors, pleaded guilty to first-degree murder, and had additional charges of attempted murder of other police officers dropped. He was sentenced to 65 years in prison. Eugene Maude came eligible for his first chance at parole last fall. Only one person went to the parole board to speak on behalf of Eugene Maude, now a 40-year-old man who has spent the majority of his life behind bars. That person was Terry Rogers. He'll share that story in a Part 2 segment next week on this program. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Back in a moment. Finally today, students all over the region are back at it. Just in the nick of time, or actually about 2 weeks late, the Dillingham City School District found its K-12 music teacher.
My name is Dane Grondin, and I'm from Shapley, Maine. I'm a pianist. I played professionally for 5 years or so, and I just recently finished up my music ed degree.
Grondin says he's pretty excited by the challenge of teaching music from the very basics for kindergartners all the way up through high schoolers who will hope to compete at the state level this year. One of the first big tests for his position will be pulling off the annual Christmas concert in December. No easy task, but he says he's confident the students will shine again this year.
I have a couple of ideas, but I probably should run by them first before I tell the whole town. But yeah, we'll figure something out, and I'm sure it will be great.
We asked Dane Grondin, former professional pianist, now music teacher at Dillingham City Schools, to play us out this week.
I loved classical music as a kid. I'd listen to it for hours, and I just would want to play all those pieces that the professionals were doing as, you know, as a 12-year-old or so. So I really learned classical really well, and I studied in New York for a couple of years and really got my technique down. I'm going to play something I wrote a couple of years ago. It's a classical piece. I actually played it at my senior recital about a year ago, actually. So. Listening to an original piece by Dillingham K-12 music teacher Dane Grondin, playing at a level some of your children may soon learn to accomplish too. That's it for this week's show. Keep in touch. Send feedback, story ideas, as well as your own songs, poems, or essays. Dave@kdlg.org is the email address to use. Find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at the KDLG website. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. See you back here next week.